Welcome back to Stacktrace, the weekly podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspective, which is me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Rambo?
Hi, John. Doing great here. How are you?
I'm doing great as well. I've been having a little bit of vacation this week, like taking some time off and enjoying the nice weather. I've been hanging out with some friends now that we can actually do that again under, you know, social distanced circumstances and things like that. So it's been really, really great. I think this is probably the most time I've been taking off for the whole year, which is maybe not the best, but, you know, it's been a busy year. It's also been one of those things where since we've been in lockdown and just staying at home, I think that me and also a lot of other people have just kind of kept working, right? Yeah. Because, well, that's what you had to do, right? I mean, trying to relax as much as possible, but yeah, now that we can finally kind of go out again under kind of safe circumstances, wearing masks and all that stuff, it's been nice to just take a little bit of time off to relax and recharge.
Yeah, and the usual disclaimer, John is in Poland, so it doesn't mean that because in Poland you can go out, and John has done that you can do it in your country. So check your local situation before doing so.
Exactly, because I think the situation is quite different from you, right, Rambo? Like in Brazil, it's still quite a tight lockdown.
Full lockdown here, yeah, so I'm
hang in there, buddy.
Home. Yeah. So, John, you've been going out and things like that, but I'm sure you have something to tell us, right? You're not going to let us down, right?
Of course, yeah. I mean, we still need to keep up with the John's game development corner, right?
Oh, nice.
So just like last week, I wanted to talk about something that's related to my game development work, but it's kind of like a bigger topic. And I mentioned on a previous episode that being a game developer and writing games involves a lot more algorithmic work than your average app. Like when we're building a quote-unquote normal app that is like a pretty picture of JSON, like we usually like to call it, which is a quote from our friend Orta. Then you're downloading JSON, you're like rendering it, you're performing some actions, you have some local database. You know, there's usually like this kind of cycle between user input and some mutation happening to your state and then the UI being updated because of that state. But with games, you have more a kind of tighter rendering loop where you're responding to actions and things in your kind of main game loop at 60 frames per second. And a lot of the things you have to do to drive most game logic, at least if you're building a, you know, somewhat sophisticated game, usually have something like maybe some AI or some kind of pathfinding or other kinds of algorithms that you need to implement. And pathfinding is a big part of the game that I am implementing right now because it's a strategy game. So you can, you know, select one of your units and you need to show what tiles, like what squares on the map that unit can move to and things like that. And as I've been working on these algorithms, I've been implementing them mostly as like pure functions where I give it the input, for example, in the case of pathfinding, the position of the unit in question, the map itself, so that I can, you know, calculate what kind of squares you could go to. And then I've been implementing that in a very recursive way, because that usually results in very, very little code and quite elegant code as well. Nice. So in the case of pathfinding, for example, there are multiple different algorithms and styles you can use when you are calculating like a movement in within a map, or if you want to find a distance from point A to point B and so on. So in the case of that, you might have like a visiting function, like a function that you run every time you visit a square and you see like what's the distance to the neighboring squares. And then you can just run that recursively on the all the different tiles and the different positions within that map. And you can end up with a really, really concise implementation. It's kind of similar to, you know, this classic interview question of can you write or implement the Fibonacci sequence, right?
Yeah.
Where you might start with like this array that iterates through numbers or something, where the Fibonacci sequence, for those of you who don't know, is like each number in the sequence is the sum of the two previous numbers. Mm-hmm. And then you realize that the Fibonacci of n is really just Fibonacci of n minus 1 plus Fibonacci of n minus 2.
Yeah.
Because, and then it's just a recursive function. So it's been really cool to just find ways to kind of model my logic in a recursive fashion and how that can result in really nice, elegant code that is also really easy to test.
Yeah, and this is one of those things in programming that still kind of bends my mind a little bit because It's not something I do all the time, but especially when working with Chibi Studio, I do a lot of work with trees, so layer trees, and that's recursive by nature. So sometimes you have to recurse like an entire layer tree. And it is something that can kind of be a little bit mind-bending if you're not used to doing it. Like, how do I exit out of this recursion? Like, right. I'm sure I'm not creating an infinite loop here. So you do have to be a little bit careful there.
Right, exactly. And another very common variant of this problem or this kind of way of working is, like you're saying, like tree traversal. So for example, if you want to find a subview within your view hierarchy, for example, in a UIKit app, you want to find a certain subview and then perform some work on it. Then you could write that as like a series of for loops, right? Where you're iterating over the child views of the given view, and then you move down, et cetera, et cetera. Or you could do it in a recursive way where you for each child view, then call that same function. So if you have a function called like find child matching and then a closure, you could first call it on the view that you're currently in, and then you could iterate over the children of that view and then call that same function on each child view, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have that recursive pattern there as well. So I mean, there are just different programming styles, but in general, when it comes to iterating over something that is a tree structure or a graph, or where you have this kind of parent-child relationship, I really prefer recursive programming because it enables you to take each of those kind of steps within the iteration and move it into a separate function that you can then test in isolation, make sure it works really well, and then you can integrate it into your main loop. So I feel like you end up with like less moving parts and less state where you have to keep track of where you are in each iteration and things like that. But the downside also, similar to when we talked about things like combine and reactive programming, is that sometimes debugging can be a little bit more challenging, where you have to find out like where in the recursion you are, and you can end up with quite deep stack traces. No pun intended. And that can be a little bit tricky sometimes. So it's a trade-off, of course. But in general, I think when writing algorithms and these kind of things, like performing some kind of search, or when you need to do something over a hierarchy or some other kind of graph structure, I really prefer the recursive design of coding.
Yeah, debugging very hot code paths using breakpoints is really tricky. And I think we talked a little bit about this when we mentioned OS log, and that's why I use it so much in Airbuddy. I recently had to debug something related to the changing of state of device, and when I'm running it here with my environment, which is full of devices, that's a really hot code path. Like, it's updating all the time with new information, so it's really hard. I put a breakpoint, and then oh, this change is not for the device I'm looking for, then I have to like put breakpoint conditions in, but then the breakpoint conditions make the code slower to run and things like that. So it can be really tricky.
Yeah, it really can. And in some of those situations, you might just go for something like OS log or print debugging or things like that, like we talked about on the previous episode. Mm-hmm. And there's really no shame in that. Like, for me, debugging is so much about finding the right tool for the current job. And I know that sometimes there's this thing where programmers are reluctant to use like basic techniques for debugging, like print. But I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. I think use whichever tool that makes you the most productive. And of course, it is always nice to get familiar with like the advanced breakpoint features and profiling features that Xcode offers, because sometimes those might be the best tool for the job. But when it comes to things like this, like, you know, heavy recursion, hot code paths, when you have some kind of timing involved, some of your UI maybe where, you know, you are responding to a drag gesture or something, you can't just put a breakpoint in there because that's going to end your drag gesture. So yeah. Debugging is a tricky topic, but it's something where there's so many different techniques to choose from.
Yeah, I've had to wrap AirPods in aluminum foil before for debugging.
Right, exactly. You have this funny thing with physical debugging, right? Where it was like, we were joking about you building a robot for opening the case, and then you actually did that.
Yeah, that was fun.
Awesome. So speaking about AirBuddy and your testing setup, how's the beta been going? Because you actually launched a beta now.
Yeah, definitely. So last Friday, I sent out the first batch of beta invites. I am running this using an actual newsletter type thing, using MailChimp, because I think the demand is a little bit higher than the first time I did a beta for AirBuddy. So I didn't want to manage all the email stuff myself. It's always good to do that with a company that's a specialist in the field. So I'm doing that this time. And I had to do something quite fun and ironic in a sense, which is I have this new icon for AirBuddy too, but I didn't want to give it away on the beta. I want it to be a surprise. So I actually had to strip it out of my beta builds, which means I had to do something Apple has to do all the time. And I'm usually on the other side finding the stuff. So this was funny. But I think I did everything correctly because I don't think it ended up in the build. It wasn't something like, oh, I would be destroyed if it was out. Like, I didn't even pay that much attention. I just put like a run script build phase to remove the new icon and that was it. But yeah, it didn't leak.
It's kind of like reverse spelunking, right? You're doing the exact same thing, but in reverse.
Yeah.
So how has the beta been working out so far? How's the feedback been? And by the way, how is your new feedback system working as well? Because we talked about it on a previous episode that you were building your own feedback system for the beta. So how has all of that been working out during the first couple of days?
Yeah, so it's been working very well. I'm very happy about that. I've gotten a lot of feedback already. Probably a lot more during the weekend, which I haven't looked at yet. But just after the initial release, I got a bunch of really good reports. And fortunately, none of those, like, my computer caught on fire type bugs. It's mainly, like, minor stuff. Like, oh, this is a little bit misaligned, or this copy is not right, or like, minor state management things, which are not that hard to fix. So I'm quite happy about this initial seed, and it seems like there aren't any like show-stopping bugs.
That's really, really great. And these kind of tweaks and things like that, like UI glitches that you mentioned, like those are some of the best things to get during a beta, at least for me. Like, because often so many of our UI configurations and things rely on state, and especially when you have something like AirBuddy where you have all these devices and these lists that are updating in real time, and they can all vary depending on what kind of devices you have. I'm guessing that can be really, really valuable as well to get that kind of feedback, to be able to, like, you know, really polish the UI to make it look really, really nice.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff related to hardware. So that's very important that I have these people testing, because they will have different setups than I have. And there's always like a subset of users who have like a different setup than you have. One instance is I got a report related to non-retina screens. And right. To be honest, I didn't really test everybody on non-retina screens. But I do have a little bit of work to do to make it a little bit more usable on non-retina displays. I ran it. I have a MacBook, a really old 11-inch MacBook Air with Mojave, which I used to test everybody running in Mojave. And when I ran it, I noticed like, oh, this looks ugly. But then I was like, oh, this is how non-retina displays look like, right? And turns out, kinda, but there is some stuff I can do to make it a little bit better. So I'm gonna do it.
Yeah, especially like modern design trends where you have these like 0.5, like half pixel lines and font sizes that might not be just whole pixels. Like basically anytime you need to do this kind of pixel rounding that tends to end up kind of blurry or misaligned or something else on non-retina displays. And yeah, it can sometimes be tricky to achieve that nice, modern, lightweight look for a UI while also being non-retina compatible as well. And thankfully, this is not really a problem we have on iOS anymore, but on the Mac, it's still a thing.
Yeah, and I also have some low contrast areas of my UI, which I have to work on. And I do want to support the high contrast mode on macOS, but non-retina displays, they don't only have issues with like lines and things like that, but also contrast. They have lower contrast by default. So there's also some work I have to do there, but it's the stuff you expect to do. But I did have a really weird bug, one of those really weird ones, which when looking at it from the outside, you kind of think, how does that happen? I actually caught it before I shipped the build. So it was actually funny because I was about to release the email and I thought, well, maybe I should like put a screenshot in there, something cool like the status window and half dark and half light mode. We can put that in the chapter art for you to see. And I was taking the screenshots, and I was taking the screenshots full screen, and I took like a bunch of screenshots. I spent like 15 minutes taking screenshots in both light and dark mode. And then when I went to look at the screenshots, the AirBuddy window wasn't showing up in the screenshots. And this is like, how? Like, I don't even know how you do that. How can you hide a window from screenshots? And then I tried to screenshot just the window by itself, and there was actually an error thrown, like, can't save screenshots.
Oh,
it's,
wow.
It's like I DRM'd my app windows.
I love it also because it's a beta, right? So you want people to take screenshots, but then you're like, nope, not allowed.
Yeah. And people maybe thought like, oh, maybe there's like an NDA or something. Oh, Rambo is really serious about this stuff. It's just a bug. And I actually listed it under the known issues. And it's one of those that you look like, you read the issue and you're like, it's not currently possible to take screenshots of the window, like what? Turns out I do some stuff, some tricks to make the status window behave in a very particular way, which is I want it to be a completely detached window, so it has to be floating above everything else, including when you switch between spaces. And it's a very similar behavior to the picture-in-picture window on macOS. If you open a pip on Safari or something and you switch between desktops, the window stays on screen at all times, including during the transition between spaces. And that's the behavior I wanted. And to do that, I have to use some private APIs on Core Graphics. And I was setting some flags on my window, and turns out some of those flags were not correct. And for some reason, it was causing the window to not appear in screenshots, which is crazy.
That's really interesting. I was going to guess that maybe you had put your window in a layer that is above the layer that the screen capturing mechanism uses, right? Mm-hmm. So that it will say, let me capture from here on and downwards in like the window hierarchy and the window management system. And that your window was like too high up, right? Like it was like above all other controls. But maybe that was not the case then. It was just a matter of using private APIs.
Yeah, and using them wrong. Like I had the wrong flags. So I fortunately fixed it. So the next build is going to be fully screenshotable.
It turns out that when you're using undocumented APIs, bad things can happen.
Absolutely.
Who would have known, right?
Yeah.
Awesome. So that's really interesting. I am looking forward to trying out AirBuddy 2 a lot more, and also to hear how the beta is going to go. And of course, when you're going to eventually ship this product. I know it's been a really long time in the works, and you've put a lot of energy and effort into it. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to hearing what the general feedback will be going forward.
Awesome. And if our listeners want to read a thread about the whole feedback thing, I think I did a decent job of describing how it works. We'll leave a link in the show notes. I did a Twitter thread this weekend with more details.
Awesome. And we keep saying this weekend because we are actually pre-recording this episode, which we don't usually do. We try to record as close as we can to when we're actually releasing the episode because we want it to be like all about the news and things like this. But this week's episode, we had to pre-record for a few different reasons. Nothing very interesting or secret or something like that. But, you know, it happens sometimes with scheduling.
Yeah.
So for our In the News segment this week, we didn't want to comment so much on the current debate, for example, between Epic and Apple, like the current App Store battle that is going on, because we already talked about it on the previous episode. And yeah, we don't want to focus too much about it. I feel like both of us, we kind of said what we wanted to say on the previous episode, right, Rambo?
Yep.
But also because that story is developing so quickly. So if we would record it now, a few days earlier, then chances are that it would be completely different by the time this episode gets released. So instead, let's talk about AirPower.
Nice, AirPower, my favorite thing to talk about.
Exactly. It's so amazing that we're now in 2020, and this is like 3 years after AirPower was originally announced and then eventually canceled, but there's still news about it. It's the dead Apple product that never wants to die.
Yeah, absolutely. So Just a quick recap. AirPower, again, was announced in 2017 during the iPhone X keynote, and my life was changed when I saw it, and I really wanted to have it, and those beautiful animations, as we've established many times here. And it was supposed to be shipped in 2018, Apple promised next year, and up until the 31st of December 2018, everyone was like, where is it? Where is it? And it didn't go out, and Apple didn't say anything about it. And then in March, after the week of shipping, when they shipped a lot of stuff, and people thought they would release AirPower at the end of the week. Well, people didn't quite get what they were expecting, and Apple actually officially canceled AirPower because it apparently couldn't meet their strict quality requirements.
And that was in March 2019, so mm-hmm. the March of the year after when it was originally promised.
Exactly, yeah. So now we're talking about this because a Chinese video was surfaced, and it shows something tearing down what looks to me like a very convincing AirPower unit, a prototype, of course. And it looks convincing to me because it does look a lot like the schematics we've seen before and some leaked pictures that were shown before. It has like 16 charging coils. And what's interesting about it and caught some people by surprise is just the density of components on the board, which is below the charging coils. And what looks like to me and what I've heard before and makes sense given what I know about AirPower, this product that never existed, is it had a separate control circuit, so a separate controller for each one of the charging coils, which is crazy.
That's really crazy. And this again kind of confirms what we've been talking about, where it was almost like Apple tried to build like 16 different Qi chargers into one, right?
Exactly.
Like with each coil having its own controller, its own little, almost like a system on a chip. Like when you look at this zoomed in version, like on this, of this board, like it's super detailed, right? And it's almost like when you looked at it from afar, it almost like looked like dirt, because it was like almost like there was like these chips with like dirt on them or something, because they were prototypes. But no, those are actually like transistors and actually real chips on each like one of these different parts. And again, we'll try to leave a link in the show notes or an image in the chapter art so you can see what it looks like. And yeah, it's just super interesting, very, very complex. And it kind of shows why this ended up not becoming viable in the end, because for a charger specifically, like it's really, really complicated. It looks like more complicated than when you open up an iPad or an iPhone and you look mm-hmm. inside. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, so it's a very small device. Like the footprint of the device itself is very small. It's very thin. Apple didn't want to put a fan in it, of course. It has an extremely high density of components, which look like they're separated by this honeycomb-like metal structure, which kind of resembles a keyboard cutout in aluminum. And it has charging coils, which, when being used, heat up. And something else that also heats up are chips. Like chips, they produce heat. And to control all of those individual controllers, because each one of those coil controllers is like a little specialized chip that's made for controlling charging coils. So each one of those is controlled by another like main chip, which was actually an Apple A something chip, maybe an A7 or something. I don't remember the exact chip. So, and it actually ran an operating system, probably a real R2Kit type system, which is not really an operating system, but anyway. And it also had Bluetooth. So imagine fitting all of that within this very tight package with everything heating up. I mean, probably chips were flying out of the board because like the solder was melting or something.
It's like a chip volcano. It's like you start charging and just chips come flying it's erupting full of chips.
Yeah, probably like that. So it was probably a nightmare.
Yeah, exactly. And it's been interesting, just like I joked in the beginning there, that this is a story that just keeps on giving, right? Like it's been really interesting just to see. And, you know, we don't have to rehash the whole thing, like, you know, what did Apple do wrong or something around the R&D process, because this is all kind of shrouded in mystery. But it's just interesting to see these puzzle pieces like come out of the manufacturing chain, of some of the prototypes and things like that, so we can see like just how complex this product was and what they were aiming to do as well. Because of course it's sad that Air Power didn't end up shipping, and I know that you are more sad about that than anyone, Rambo. But it's also interesting to see kind of why it didn't end up working and kind of the technical reasons and just the sheer complexity of these prototypes.
Yeah, I think what's fascinating about this is, especially to us who are nerds, of course, is that this is, first of all, it's Apple. So it's a company that's known for not announcing things beforehand, before they know they're going to ship them. And they did. It's also a company that's known for being able to do things that look like magic. And they, when you look at them, you think, how did they do this? And it's also a product that on the surface looks very simple. Like, what's so hard about making a charging pad? Like, just put the coils in there, John. It's so easy, right?
Exactly.
And so I think the combination of all of these factors is what makes this such an interesting topic. And I can't wait for people's NDAs to expire so we can hear the full story behind Air Power.
Yeah, exactly. Thermals especially, it feels like, are becoming more and more of a topic because, you know, as computers have advanced and as we're seeing kind of the quote-unquote end of Moore's law and how the kind of miniaturization of systems and chips and process shrinks and things like that is continuing to get more and more complex as we're reaching like the single-digit nanometers in terms of, you know, process size. Mm-hmm. It's just interesting, like, how we are bumping now up towards the kind of limits of physics, where it's like certain products can't happen because it just turns out to be kind of physically impossible because of thermals or because of, you know, interference or whatever it might be. And that combined with how all electronic gadgets are now expected to be so thin and light, like, it must be like an sometimes impossible equation to like balance all of these different factors like thinness, lightness, battery life, heat, processing power, speed, etc., etc. So like the insights we can get into this process, both when it succeeds and when it fails, is just so interesting to see, just because like electronics and especially the type of electronics that we're into, like, you know, phones and tablets and computers and charging pads, it's just so interesting, like, the sheer complexity of all of these things that go into it these days.
Yeah, definitely. So things are harder than they seem sometimes, and this was a great example of that.
Exactly. Because like you mentioned, like, the magic of Apple is when they succeed, they make it look so simple on the surface, but it's really complicated under the hood, which is always a tricky kind of balance, right? When you have a lot of complexity that you're hiding under some kind of, almost like an abstraction in terms of code, right?
Yeah.
If you have something really, really complicated under the hood that you have to manage, but then you want to present this nice, easy to use, simple surface to your end users.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. So let's see if we're going to have more Air Power stories in the future. Probably. Like, again, this seems like the thing we're going to talk about even 10 years from now. But, you know, we're going to keep bringing it up whenever we find one of these stories because, well, Air Power is always near and dear to our heart. Isn't that right, Rambo?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. But now let's move on to our deep dive segment for this episode. But before we do, let's take a very quick break and thank this episode's sponsor. This week's episode of Stack Trace is brought to you by Alogic, which 9to5 Mac is teaming up with to give away Apple's latest MacBook Air to celebrate the launch of Alogic's new 10-in-1 SuperDock. As the world's first universal 10-in-1 USB-C SuperDock for Windows and Mac, the new Alogic SuperDock increases the functionality of your MacBook or iPad Pro by adding ports for just about anything you'll need. That includes two 4K 60Hz HDMI ports, which work across all major platforms, Mac, Windows, and Chromebooks. In addition to the ability to connect external monitors, this dock also provides access to a full range of connections over USB-C and USB-A, Ethernet, audio, and it also includes SD and micro SD card readers for transferring your data, photos, and videos, all with 100 watts of power delivery. The SuperDock also features twin upstream USB-C cables to provide support for a wide range of computers. The two USB-C connectors are magnetic and can be connected or detached as required, giving you the flexibility to use the dock with any USB-C or Thunderbolt 3 enabled computer. So check out this new super doc from Alogic, which you can find a link to in the show notes. And for a limited time only, you can also get a massive 50% discount on the super doc on Indiegogo. And if you live in either the US or Canada, then also make sure to enter 9to5 Max and Alogic's MacBook Air giveaway, which you can also find a link to in the show notes. Thanks a lot to Alogic for sponsoring this week's episode of Stacktrace. All right, Rambo, so now it's time for our deep dive segment. And we haven't actually done any deep dives now on the last couple of episodes because we've been so busy talking about the news and also talking about them like kind of in depth from a developer's perspective as well. But on this episode, we wanted to get back into our normal schedule and talk about something technical, kind of in depth. So what are we going to talk about on this episode?
We're going to talk about yet another one of those things that looks simple on the surface, but is actually really complicated, and that's syncing.
Exactly. Building a syncing or a synchronization system that works well, which lets users sync their data across different devices. And like you mentioned, it's one of those things where if it works, it can kind of look like magic, and it can make an app so much smoother to use because a lot of people these days, you know, they have a Mac maybe, they have an iPhone, an iPad, and they use the same app across different devices. And if we're building an app that fits into that kind of workflow, then sync has become almost like an expectations from users, right? Where you're expected to be able to use the same data or your same kind of files across all of your devices. But what is it that makes that kind of syncing so incredibly difficult?
I think it's the potential for race conditions. So I think that summarizes it quite well. So when you want to sync data between different devices or different users even, you have the problem of when things go out of sync. And it sounds counterintuitive, like, okay, but I'm syncing, how can things go out of sync? Well, connection is not perfect, and things can be offline for a long time. So it's the old problem, like, let's say I have a document on my computer, and then I do some edits, and I add a paragraph to the end of this document, and then I shut down my computer before it has a chance to sync. And then I open up my iPad and I have the same document there and it's syncing with my Mac. I don't have that paragraph in there. And then I go and I delete the last paragraph of my document on my iPad. And then my iPad is going to sync up to the server. What should happen when I open up the same document on my Mac? Like, which paragraph is going to be deleted? Where is the paragraph I inserted before goes? How does it solve that problem? I think that's the biggest issue.
Exactly, because pretty much the simplest implementation of a synchronized system would be to always use the latest copy, right? Mm-hmm. So that works for single values often, right? Where if you just have a single value that you're syncing, you could, in some cases at least, say that, okay, the latest value that will sync to the server is the truth, which means that if then you have the situation where a device has been offline for a while, it just fetches the latest value and then it uses that. And then you can end up with a race condition, like you said, where if different devices start submitting that value, then how do you decide which one is the correct one to use, right?
Yeah.
And if in the case for a single value, you could perhaps use the timestamp to determine that or some other kind of heuristics. But when you're working with something more free form, like a document or an image or a code base or some kind of canvas or things like that, it's not that easy because then you all of a sudden have inserts combined with mutations, combined with additions, moving things around, like all sorts of different operations can happen at different levels of granularity. Because wouldn't it be nice if users always wrote whole paragraphs in a document, right?
Yeah.
And you could say, add this paragraph or remove this paragraph. But sometimes you edit things in the middle of a paragraph. And you want to make things that are performant, so you can't always just like do a complete diff on each document and try to figure things out with really advanced heuristics, because that will also be really difficult as well. So it is a very difficult problem with lots of different edge cases.
Yeah, and let's say your document has formatting, and then on one machine you make a phrase bold, and in the middle of the phrase in the other machine you add a link to one of the words in that sentence. I think the correct way would be to make it bold and make the link, but then also be bold. But that's a really hard problem to solve. And I think what makes it so difficult with syncing is what we talked about. There is no single strategy that works for everything. It highly depends on the domain you're working with. So, for instance, in the WWDC app for Mac, we have iCloud Sync. And one of the things we sync is the position you are within a particular video. So if you've watched a half an hour of a 1 hour session, it's going to send that information to iCloud and you pick it up on another machine and you keep going from where you left off. But in that case, if we have an issue with syncing and we have conflicting information, we always make the latest information win, because like it doesn't make sense if I go back in a video and then I go to another machine and I'm forward in that video that the position I was in before wins. Like, it doesn't make sense. So that's a very simple, like, one value, the latest one wins. But then that's a thing that's very specific to this particular problem domain. And if you're working with something else, if you're working with images or text or code is a type of text, but it's different than normal text. It changes a lot depending on what we're working with.
Yeah, it really does. And the different domains require different kind of levels of sophistication when it comes to how you do your sync. And you mentioned code there, and I wanted to bring up something interesting here where with code, we do have a pretty standard tool for solving sync, which is Git, right? Mm-hmm. So most teams, I will say these days, are using Git or some other very similar kind of source control system where you are making it a lot more explicit on the user's end to actually like make commits, submit commits, right? Where each commit is actually like a mutation, right? And then you have these atomic mutations that can be applied in order, and you have branches that have different commits in order. So you could say, like, if I move from this branch to this branch, I have this order of commits and I can merge this branch into this branch, taking the commits that are ahead of the other branch and moving them in. And there's all kinds of strategies on how to merge those. And I think anyone who's ever worked on an iOS app that, for example, uses a storyboard or an Xcode project file, you've probably seen these conflicts happen where we as users need to resolve those conflicts locally and say, okay, here's how I actually want to resolve a conflict in my Xcode project file, for example. If one file has been added and one file has been deleted at the same place, for example, where Git is not able to just solve that confidently on its own. And that's interesting because that's a very different approach to what most synchronization systems use when it comes to apps with UIs and user-facing things, where you are more trying to do everything automatic and not let the users themselves solve conflicts. Although there are many different apps that do have some form of conflict resolution window where they will pop up and say, would you like to use this version or this version? Or they would do something where they will save two copies on the file system and one will be called like conflict or something. And then you can always go back and take a look at that so that you don't lose data.
Yeah, I think the main goal with any type of merge strategy or conflict resolution strategy is to prevent data loss. Like, that's the main thing you're trying to do, because the last thing you want is for your user to lose data, of course. So I think even if it's not perfect and fully automatic, at least give the user a chance to resolve it themselves.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where it's better to have duplicate data than to lose one of the copies, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So for example, if we again use the document analogy, if I'm writing a document, maybe together with other people, or I just sync it between my different devices, and all of a sudden I have a duplicate paragraph, that's better than the paragraph being gone completely.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. So when talking about syncing, and we're talking, of course, specifically in Apple's platforms, Apple offers a very powerful tool for that, which is CloudKit.
Exactly. And CloudKit is one of my favorite frameworks, and I think one of yours as well,
yep.
Because I feel like it really, really hits that sweet spot between complexity and power. And you say you already called a very powerful framework, but it's also pretty easy to use, at least initially, once you get kind of used to it and you know what the APIs are. It's not one of those things where you have to write everything yourself, but also it really includes like a really powerful set of defaults, and you can customize things quite a bit if you really want to.
Yeah, definitely. And I think a problem many people have with CloudKit is that they expect it to be a drop-in sync solution, but it's not, I wouldn't call it like a syncing solution. It's not a solution. It's a tool which lets you implement your syncing solution if you want to. But they actually, and my main complaint about CloudKit for a long time was that in order to actually create your syncing solution using CloudKit, there was a lot of boilerplate you had to write, because the whole syncing thing with CloudKit, like the main use case, which is syncing user private data to a local database, whether that's Realm or CoreData or file system or something, it requires a lot of boilerplate and a lot of state management, which you had to do manually. But they actually solved that last year by introducing the new CoreData and CloudKit integration. And as much as people love to hate CoreData, I don't subscribe to that vision. I actually like CoreData. I think it's a great framework. Again, very powerful. Again, it has its problems. It could be easier to use. It could have a swiftier overlay on top of it, which I hope they do sometime. But I do like it as a local database solution. And they actually released their own integration. So you can basically change the name of a class and your stuff magically, and I'm doing magically in quotes here, syncs to other devices. And from the experience of other people using it, it seems like it's working pretty well for folks. It has some limitations again. It doesn't support sharing, I think. This year, they actually added support to use the public database with the CoreData and CloudKit thing, which can be useful for like more social type apps. But yeah, I really like that they've done it. Would you like to hear more about the boilerplate I was talking about?
Yeah, sure. And I also wanted to mention also that I think they've made a lot of improvements with CloudKit over the years to make it also work better offline, right? Mm-hmm. So that you can actually store your models offline without always having to do that process manually. Because a CloudKit model is kind of like a fancy dictionary, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're storing things using keys and values and then encoding those and sending them off to the CloudKit server. And that's how you get your sync. Like the models are stored in the CloudKit backend, they can download them. So let's talk a little bit more about the boilerplate. And then also I would love to talk about the versioning system and how kind of CloudKit prevents these kind of errors and conflicts that we talked about earlier, or maybe doesn't completely prevent them, but at least helps you move in the right direction when it comes to avoiding conflicts and data loss.
Yeah, so I'm gonna try my best to summarize here the whole process. And this is something I wrote a long time ago in Chibi Studio, I think. And I actually have an implementation of this in the open source WWDC app, so people can check it out. It's more specific to using Realm as the database, but it does handle lots of tricky things in there, which you'll see. It is a little bit tricky. So the first thing you have to do if you want to sync users' private data to CloudKit is check if there's an iCloud account available. So
right,
the user might not be logged into iCloud. That's quite rare in my experience. Like most users, especially on iOS, they will have an iCloud account. So that's usually not a problem, but it's something you have to ensure exists. And on top of that, in subsequent launches of your app, or even during your app launch, and there's a notification you can observe for that, if the iCloud account changes, so if the user signs out and signs into another iCloud account, you have to make sure that you delete your local data and fetch the, basically start the whole process again. So that's something to keep in mind as well. And it's something we don't do in the WWDC implementation, by the way. That's something I would have to add in there. But it is a little bit of an edge case. Like, it's not very common that people change their iCloud accounts, but it's something to keep in mind. So once you establish that there's an iCloud account available, you have, and I say you have to do it in the way I do it and in the way Apple recommends it in their official guide. So you don't have to do this, but I like to create a custom CloudKit zone. So CloudKit has the concept of zones, and in the private database, in the private domain, you can have multiple zones, which you can think of them like folders, basically, but they're not folders. But anyway, if you create a custom zone, you can do more things and more granular change tracking within that zone. And we're going to talk about the change tracking later. So if there is no custom zone created, you will create that custom zone. And then you check if you have a subscription for changes in that zone, because one of the things you can do with CloudKit is subscribe to be notified when things change within a particular database, within a particular record type, or in a whole record zone, which is, I think, the best way to do it if you want to sync like a whole bunch of different types of records. So you just subscribe to changes within that zone. So anytime anything within a record in any database in that zone is changed, you're going to be notified. You get a push notification, a silent one. And you create a subscription if you don't have it. And then you fetch changes from CloudKit and save them to your local database. That's one of the important parts there. And you're going to include in your local record, whether it's like a field in core data or realm or on your file system, you have to key archive the CK record ID of your record, because that's how you can map between your local thing and what's in CloudKit.
Exactly. And that would be similar for many different kinds of syncing solutions, that you would have some kind of ID that you're using for your actual syncing models, and then you want to make sure to connect your local models to that. And the strategy that you mentioned there is a quite common one, I think, where you're essentially treating the server as the source of truth, and then you are updating your local database using like the new models that come in from the server and things like that. But another tricky situation here, which, like I mentioned earlier, CloudKit does help with somewhat, is what if you fetch a model, you perform some updates to it, and then you sync it back to the server? So it can be something like, you know, you fetch a chat conversation and you append a message to the array of messages, and then you send that conversation model back. What happens if you are trying to send it back, but in the meantime, the model has already changed? Then you could end up with data loss because you could overwrite the newest model with your model, which is now out of date. Like, this is how tricky it is.
Yeah.
But that is something that CloudKit prevents, thanks to its versioning system, where it will give you an error and say, you cannot perform this update because you are using an old version of the model, essentially. And then you have a different kind of strategy you can use there. You could either resync the model again, try to apply your mutation and sync it back. You could try to do some kind of conflict resolution. But I do like the fact that CloudKit at least has that kind of safety mechanism built in, so you don't accidentally overwrite models with kind of old copies.
Yeah, CloudKit has different strategies. And one of them, which is the one I recommend using with this approach I'm mentioning here, is to use the changed keys. So each record has different keys. And you can use the changed keys strategy so that, let's say, in this array of messages, you have your messages, but you also have like a title for some reason in the whole model. And the messages are in conflict, but they haven't changed between the local and the remote thing. But then I change the title, just the title, but the title is not in conflict. It will change the title just fine if I use this strategy. Or you can use the more aggressive one and say, if anything is not in sync, let me know. And CloudKit is almost like error-driven development, because it's very common for developers, like when some API gives you an error, you just like print it to the console and forget about it.
Don't do that. That's not a good error handling strategy.
And another one is just throw an alert on screen to the user, like error and the error message. Don't do that with CloudKit. You're going to be very sad if you do that. With CloudKit, you get very precise errors, and it has a CK error type, and it has a CK error.code enum with all of the different types of errors that can occur. And of course, you're not gonna have to like switch between all of them, but there are some very specific error types you have to be looking for. And if you look at the code I mentioned in the WWDC app, you'll see that we handle some specific types of errors in a special manner. One of them, I think, is zone deleted, which happens like you can go in settings and delete iCloud data for a particular app. And when you do that, the zone that was created is deleted, and then you have to recreate it. So that's one of the errors we handle especially. And something you can do also to prevent a little bit of rate limiting issues and also issues with more conflicts happening is to coalesce changes. So if there are lots and lots of changes happening in quick succession, you can coalesce those changes and not like fire a database operation for each change that happens. I think that's a good thing to do as well. And the way you keep track of where you are in your timeline of syncing with CloudKit is through change tokens. So when you go to fetch changes from CloudKit, like I mentioned, which is a very important step, you will send it a change token, which is like this opaque string. It's kind of like a hash of sorts. And that's what tells CloudKit where the client is within the timeline. So you have a token, you send it to CloudKit, it sends you back the changes, and it sends you back the current token. And then you store it locally so that your client knows where it is. And the first time, of course, you don't have a token, so you just tell it, hey, give me everything.
Exactly. And this kind of approach, which is kind of like a cursor approach, where you're telling the backend system, like, here's where the cursor is at. Almost like if you have a cursor inside of a document. And that approach can also be really useful when you're implementing other kinds of things as well. For example, pagination. Because when you're paging through a set of data, let's say you have a list of 1,000 movies, and every page you have 25 movies, and then you go next, next, next. What if a movie is added or removed during that pagination process? Then you could end up missing some data, or you could end up being lost, like your indexes are no longer valid. And having a cursor or a token, like Rambo mentioned here, which CloudKit is using, can be a great way to avoid that problem, where you could say, here is where I was currently at. And if the backend has performed some kind of mutation, like a insert or delete, it can know how to offset that token accordingly. And that can be really useful in that kind of situation as well.
Yeah, definitely. And so after you've set up this whole thing, you are going to, every time your app is launched, check the local database for changes that have not been uploaded yet. This is after you fetch changes from the remote server. A good way to check if something has been uploaded or not is not to like have a flag that is uploaded or something, but check if your local model has a CloudKit ID. We mentioned that when you download them from the remote service, you will store the ID locally, and the same happens after you upload them. So if they don't have a local ID for the CloudKit record ID, then you upload them. And then you're going to do the same thing we did for CloudKit, which is to observe, create a subscription and observe when changes happen. You're going to do the same thing for your local database. So every database has some sort of system where you can subscribe to changes on that database. And you do that, and then you upload the data as it arrives. And of course, you coalesce changes so that you're not firing like 50 requests every second or something.
Right.
And then I mentioned the creating the subscription and fetching changes. That will fire a silent push notification to your app whenever something changes remotely. When that happens, you will do the same thing I mentioned in the first step, which is check if there's an iCloud account, check if the zone exists, check if the subscription exists, and then fetch the changes with the latest change token, save them to the database. And that way, the system goes on and on. It's a kind of like a loop. And actually, one of the things you need to be careful about when writing sync code is to not create sync loops. So if you say, send something from your local database and that somehow triggers your app to be notified, that's bad. It's going to like make an infinite sync loop, and that's not very good. But the CloudKit subscription will not fire for things you have uploaded locally. That would be kind of bad.
Yeah, exactly. So those were some really good tips around CloudKit specifically, and also around some other techniques as well. But I also wanted to talk about one other kind of approach to syncing that you could also opt for, which you could use with other kinds of systems like your own custom backend or other kind of storage providers or something like that, which is almost like to treat your data model as a Git repository. And that might sound crazy, but that's actually a technique used by a lot of different companies and a lot of systems. And I'm sure there's some aspect of that inside of CloudKit's own implementation as well, where instead of sending complete models up and down, like syncing complete models, sending this particular like serialized instance of this model to the server and then either getting like an error back or getting the new model back and things like that, to send mutations, to send here is what I've added at this point, here's what I've removed at this point, here is a change and so on, exactly like Git commits. Like Git commits are essentially additions and removals, right? And if you do that, then you might end up with like consuming more data and you might need to like replay those mutations on an original model in order to get the current state, but it can be a way to avoid conflicts in many different situations, just like Git does. Like, again, we do get Git conflict sometimes, especially if we're working with a larger team, but Git handles so many of the most common conflict resolution problems just because of its nature of applying patches to one single data set, which we can also do without using Git specifically, but by using the same architecture, like sending and receiving mutations rather than complete models.
Yeah, something that uses that, I think, is the Paw app, the REST client. I think when you use their cloud solution, they're actually using that, because I've seen like branches and conflict things in Paw, which look very much like Git, and it works really well. Like I have some huge projects in Paw and I've never lost anything or had issues with it not being in sync. So it can be a solution. And to solve the problem you mentioned of too much history data, basically, what you can do, if it's not your intention to let the user go back in history infinitely, is you can aggregate that those changes eventually, and then you basically start fresh from time to time and create Git tags, maybe.
So exactly, releases. Yeah,
exactly. So that you, of course, you can, like, if you have a document, well, actually, on GitLand, this is actually quite common. Like, we have a project that's in existence since 2012 or something, and it's everything is in Git. But yeah, that's for like a developer project. I don't think people would be very happy if their text document ended up taking like 5 gigabytes of disk space.
No, exactly. And the strategy for doing that kind of merging of those mutations into the main model itself, you could decide that on many different factors. One way to do it would be, for example, going back to the messages analogy from before, if you have a group conversation, if all users, like all devices, has seen a message, then you could bake that into the model itself, right?
Yeah.
Because then that mutation has kind of served its purpose and there is no more chance for conflict, hopefully not. And then you can kind of merge that into the main model. So yeah, it's also just another option to consider, especially if you're building a sync system on your own. I think it could be an approach to take a look at.
Yeah, and especially if you're building something like a developer tool, and which might not be like a text editor or a code editor or something, but if you can somehow expose those Git bits and your audience is comprised of developers, I mean, developers are going to be very happy, because even if something happens, like a merge conflict or something, they know that and they can fix it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how most package managers work. For example, the Swift package manager is all powered by Git and CocoaPods and so on. So they actually use Git as their kind of syncing engine, if you will, or like how to resolve packages and dependency graphs. So yeah, Git can be a really powerful tool in many different situations, either like directly or by using the same kind of architecture that Git is using.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. So that was a true deep dive, I think.
Yeah.
That was a very good deep dive. If you have any follow-up questions or anything you'd like us to go into more detail around, either when it comes to CloudKit or Core Data or syncing in general or any of these other things we talked about, then let us know. You can always tweet at us with the hashtag AskStackTrace to send us questions, and we'll try to answer them on a future show. And one person who has done that this week is Mauro. And Mauro asks if we know whether we can use the App Store Connect API to implement paid Mac apps. So Mauro says that he is considering building an app to show some stats around app downloads, sales, etc., and is wondering whether the App Store Connect API is something we can use commercially.
Yeah, so as far as I know, there is no restriction about it. I know of a few apps who do it already. There is the Native Connect app, which is a really good App Store Connect client. So yeah, I would say it's fine. I've seen more than one app do it already, so I think it's fine.
That's cool. But I also wanted to bring up a kind of more wider point here. I like to do this with these questions. and that is, like, when you're picking these APIs, I think it's very important to, A, like, read the terms and conditions. I know it can be really boring, right? Like, they can be pages and pages and pages of, like, lawyer speak text, right? Yeah. But to make sure that you're actually following them and that your use case fits into what is allowed when it comes to this particular API, especially when it comes to using it for commercial purposes, because a lot of APIs put restrictions on, like, not, you have to use it only for non-commercial purposes. And of course, there's a lot of gray zones between that, right? Like, if you rely on some kind of advertising or something, is it commercial? Is it not? Well, I'm not a lawyer, neither is Rambo, but make sure to check those things out, right? And then the second thing is, like, when I pick an API, especially when it comes to something that's going to be central to my application, like I am working on a client for something, I want to make sure that my use case falls within the kind of mainstream use of that API. So if I have something where I think, like, oh, maybe I could use this particular web API to solve my issue, but maybe it's not something that they really considered when designing it. Maybe I'm slightly misusing it or using it in a way it wasn't designed for. That's something that I try to avoid. And I'm not saying that Mauro is doing that here, but I just wanted to bring that up as a point here as well, that when you're picking your APIs, I would suggest at least to try to be like a mainstream consumer of it, because otherwise you're going to run into edge cases and that might not be supported. You might need to wait for support or for new releases. So I always try to be in the mainstream when it comes to the APIs that I'm using.
Yeah, exactly. And just for the record, the other app I was talking about is AppStat. And it's also in, I'm not sure actually if it's in the App Store, but we'll leave a link to the app in the show notes. And it's a really cool menu bar app that shows you an overview of your sales data, and it is using the App Store Connect API.
Cool. So we'll leave a link in the show notes to those two apps. We'll leave a link in the show notes to the code samples that Rambo mentioned earlier and all of the other things that we talked about as well. And you can find the show notes in your podcast player or at 9to5mac.com. But that's it for this episode. So all that remains is to thank our great sponsor for this episode, which was Alogic. Make sure to check them out as well. But most of all, thank you so much for listening, everybody. And we'll talk to you again next week. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.